Welcome to the Hoopsite Podcast. My name is Alex Kennedy. This is episode number 217. We post new episodes twice a week, so be sure to subscribe and check back. Today I'm joined by Howard Beck, who does a fantastic job covering the NBA for Bleacher Report. He's one of the best writers in the business, and he's the perfect guest to break down the NBA's return. Make sure you're following him on Twitter, at Howard Beck. Howard, thanks for joining me. How are you?
I'm doing well, Alex. How are you?
I'm doing well. This is a really interesting time. I'm curious to see how things play out here. On July 31st, the NBA will resume the season at Disney's Wide World of Sports in Orlando. It's going to be so interesting. You have 22 teams at a neutral location, living in a bubble, no fans at the games. It'll be unlike anything we've seen before. What do you think of this arrangement that the NBA came up with, and what do you think of the NBA's bubble idea? Do you think it'll work?
Well, it almost has to, right? You know, there really aren't any other alternatives. The every time I talk about this, the first thing I always say is we have to caveat this discussion with the fact that we are talking now on June 9th. July 31st is a long way away. And while it might not seem that far off, think about what the last 3 months have brought us as NBA media or as fans, as society at large. Like, everything has changed so dramatically in our world and continues to evolve. That I don't think we can anticipate anything about where the world will be on July 31st with regard to the virus, with regard to social unrest and the movement that we're seeing unfold right now. There's just I predict nothing. But on the assumption that July 31st will actually be when the NBA season resumes in Orlando in the virtual bubble. So there's a second caveat, really. We haven't seen, and maybe it'll be today, we have not yet seen exactly specifically the NBA's protocols for dealing with the virus. Now, there's been leaks and reporting on it, but I think we need to see the final version, the version that's been negotiated and signed off by both the league and the Players Association. We don't have it yet. And so I do think there are still some legitimate questions about how they're going to handle this and what the consequences will be, or what the reaction and protocols will be for dealing with, you know, anybody testing positive, what it will take to keep going, what it might take to shut it down, what threshold would they have to hit before they decide this isn't worth it or this is too risky. And on that note, I would just say that the NBA is walking a fine line here. The clear path to the safest, most efficient version of a restart would have been to go with the 16 teams that were already playoff slotted when the season was suspended. Top eight in each conference, nice and clean. And it's just a matter of simple math and science here, that the more bodies you bring into the bubble, the more risk there is, the more chance there is of someone bringing in an infection or getting infected at some point, spreading it. Fewer bodies, fewer teams is safer. That's fairly straightforward and I think irrefutable. But the NBA is looking at more than just those factors. They do have, you know, there's some competitive issues at play here, but more than anything, there's money issues at play. And more teams means more games, which means more games on TV, which means more revenue. And that is no small thing. And of course, there are teams that also just, they wanted to be part of this. They did not want to be left out and to go 9 months without playing, to go 9 months with being off of their fans' radar. And so there's a big downside to limiting it too much. So I understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. I do think that there was a strong case to be made, revenue notwithstanding, and that's obviously a very big notwithstanding to throw in there. But revenue notwithstanding, there was a very strong case to be made to go 16 teams and just get this thing over with as quickly as possible. I would have even advocated for a best of five first round as they used to have. The less time you're spending total in this bubble, the better off you are with regard to the virus and even just the burden on these teams and all their personnel who are going to be spending, you know, potentially, if you're on a team that makes the finals, 3 months away from family.
Yeah, I talked to an Eastern Conference general manager a few days ago, and he was wondering what the NBA will do if some players decide they don't want to risk their health and play. You know, they're feeling like, hey, I don't want to be away from my family for several months. I don't want to risk my health here. You know, or what if a team loses a few games and is no longer in the mix for a playoff spot? You know, those teams fighting for the eighth seed, do those players want to shut it down and go home? Do you think that could be an issue, players not wanting to play or risk their health?
So far, there hasn't been much public murmuring about that. But it won't surprise me if somebody opts out. You know, there are players in this league who have asthma, you know, treatable asthma, obviously, because they're still playing in the NBA. But, you know, that's just one example. We've had, you know, it's been, what, 15 years maybe, but, you know, Jason Collier, who played for the Atlanta Hawks, died suddenly because of an unknown heart condition. I think it was an enlarged heart, if I'm recalling correctly. Not everybody knows everything about what may be going on internally. So when you talk about, you're not at risk if you are young and healthy, unless there's some underlying health issue. There are some that are known, and there's some that might be unknown, and maybe you have a family history of something. I mean, I'm just, you know, thinking out loud on this, right? Like, I don't know what factors might lead somebody to decide that it's not worth the risk, but I do think that that is something that everybody has to consider. And the other part of this is very rarely talked about, but, you know, if you talk to public health officials on this and epidemiologists, doctors who have studied the coronavirus, this particular infection, the COVID-19 illness, sometimes leaves people diminished afterward. They get through it. It's not killing everybody, and plenty of people in their 20s and 30s, you know, are surviving it, but then coming out at the other end with more limited lung capacity, or effects, you know, lasting effects to their cardiovascular system, or, you know, other organs. Like, there's some unknowns here, and that's a big risk. And what if, you know, you're an NBA player who's made millions and it has the potential to be making tens of millions more, and that's put at risk by the lasting effects of this virus, suddenly leaving you less capable of playing at an elite level. I mean, again, I'm not saying that that is a high probability, but I think there's just so much unknown that it's rational for guys to have these concerns going in and to need maximum reassurance. And you hope that because of all that everybody will be, you know, as diligent as they can be about staying inside the bubble and not interacting with people outside of it and not taking any undue risks while they're in Orlando.
Yeah, and we're hearing, you know, if a player leaves the bubble, they'd have to quarantine for 10 to 14 days and must have two negative tests in order to resume play. I know players are going to be holding themselves accountable and their teammates accountable, trying to make sure no one tries to leave or anything like that. So it'll be interesting. There's still some unanswered questions, though. One of the big ones, you know, what happens if a player gets sick? We kind of discussed a little bit, but it sounds like the player would isolate for a period of time, and assuming he's okay, his team would try to get him back on the court once he is, you know, healthy and has tested negative several times. Teams can also choose to assign a replacement player from the free agent pool, you know, a G League guy. Although that player would have to quarantine for a number of days when they arrive before being able to play. Do you think we'll see some of these replacement players get signed?
Well, that's a hard thing to speculate on. I think it's inevitable that they're going to need more players who are outside of the current rosters. Because I don't think it's not the virus that's going to create some roster concerns. I think it's going to be injuries, unfortunately. Yeah. Guys have just been off so long. There's no precedent for this. This is not, like the off season. Like, we've already, I think, exceeded the number of days of in a normal off season. But also, this is not a normal off season. Most players did not have access to, fitness equipment. They did not have access to trainers. They did not have access to basketball courts to even play pickup. A lot of them didn't have access even to a rim to shoot at, period. And so, you know, they're going to, you know, have a ramp up period where they're practicing together and training together and play some exhibitions and all that, I'm sure. But I just think that, again, and this is, you know, one of the other, I think, you know, kind of a, just a, you know, caveats to put on the whole enterprise in trying to get back and in trying to get squeezed in this many games and this many teams and everything. I do think the NBA has just kind of assumed some greater risk of injury too. And you hope that it's not a lot and you hope that it's nothing serious, but I feel like it's almost inevitable.
Yeah, even if guys were working out, it's so hard to mimic those game movements and game intensity when you're working out at your house or in an apartment without fitness equipment. You know, so even if guys were trying to do cardio and keep in some kind of shape, it's not the same as game shape or doing those game movements. So, you know, fortunately, the training camp and the ramp up period will help, I think. But yeah, I mean, that could be really a huge concern. We could see a lot of significant injuries. Hopefully it doesn't happen, but it would not surprise me either. So yeah, having that plan for those replacement players is important, you know, COVID aside. So we'll see what happens with that. There's been some talk about how the NBA will handle home court advantage and other logistical things. You know, it's hard to replicate the advantage a team would get from having home court advantage in a normal postseason. But have you heard any ideas for how the NBA can reward those teams for their regular season play?
No good ones. The stuff that's been floated out there, I think, is all preposterous. I don't believe in the idea that because you would have had home court advantage and now there's no home court, you should be getting an extra foul or you should be getting an extra possession or and like that. You're mangling and you're warping the game. You're warping the integrity of the game at that point because, you know, the game is, you know, it's four quarters, it's 48 minutes. Possessions are determined based on the play. Fouls are determined based on, rules that were set down decades ago. Like, let's not start screwing with that stuff. There's two ways of looking at this. In the early rounds, you shouldn't need the home court advantage. If you're the Lakers and you have LeBron and Anthony Davis, your advantage is that you have LeBron and Anthony Davis. You should not need a home court advantage to beat the eighth seed. Same goes for the second and third seeds. You know, fourth, fifth is always a little bit of a toss-up matchup in the NBA. But in general, first-round matchups, I don't think this is even really that relevant. Now, by the time you get to the conference finals, for sure, and the finals, that's something that in a normal season you have fought for. You want that home court advantage, and it can be really critical. And we've seen, obviously, some really big game sevens over the decades, including one that I just wrote about recently, about the Lakers and Blazers in 2000. And the Blazers believe that if that game seven had been at the Rose Garden instead of Staples Center, they would have won. But I think in general, talent is what wins out. The better team wins out. And while home court is certainly very significant in the NBA, there's plenty of analytics, studies over the years to, bear out that home court advantage matters a lot. I also think that, look, these are incredibly unusual circumstances. Everyone's just doing the best you can. I don't want to bring in the concept of fairness, not when it comes to who makes the playoffs, not when it comes, like, that's why I was fine with cutting it off at 16. I don't care about fairness right now. There's no fair. There's a global pandemic. The NBA is just trying to get going again. At a certain point, you have to throw out, traditional concepts of what seems fair or equitable or preserving some sense of the advantages that you thought you won. I'm sorry. The season could not continue. You can't play at home. You can't play in front of fans. If that means there's no home court advantage, I say so be it. Now, you could get really creative. You could take all the sights and sounds of Staples Center, of the Rose Garden. I won't call it the other thing. Of the Smoothie King Center, of the, I just love that it's the Smoothie King Center.
I know, it's amazing.
I'm a big smoothie fan. You could take all the sights and sounds of the Vivint Home Energy something or other, whatever, in Utah. You could take these things and you could pipe them in, right? And you could the NBA is clever about this and we have the technology to do this. You could make it so that when Donovan Mitchell hits a big shot, you could have the Utah Jazz or the Utah version of that crowd screaming for it. And when, LeBron steps to the line, you could have the booing. And like you could simulate all of this if you wanted to. It wouldn't be that hard. And you could slap down decals on the court to make it the Lakers court or the Blazers court or the Jazz's court or the Sixers court. Like all of this is doable if you wanted to get creative. And it would kind of sound like, but intellectually, you're going to have this disconnect because you're going to look up and there's nobody in the crowd actually making that noise. There's nobody there actually booing you. There's nobody there actually chanting MVP. But that's about the best I could think of if you really feel like this is important. And look, they're going to want to create some atmosphere anyway, so maybe it makes sense to tailor it to one team's home court for each, you know, as they go back and forth in the virtual 2-2-1-1-1 the 2-2-1-1-1. But I don't know if that's really necessary or justified, or if it's, you know, that logical.
Yeah, and you know, one of the advantages of home court advantage is not just the fans, but also you're just at home, you're in your own routine, you're used to the rims, you're playing, you know, in a surrounding, an atmosphere that you're used to. Whereas here, you know, it's going to be a neutral site, so neither team can complain. You know, no one's familiar with these gyms, these rims. You know, you're not having the same game day routine as you usually do at home. So there's a lot of things that are just thrown out the window. And I like that the NBA is trying to figure out what to do and trying to reward those teams the regular season, but like you said, it's the middle of a pandemic, things aren't fair, and deal with it. So we'll see how that goes. I am curious though, I've been out to Impact Basketball or IMG Academy or any of these different off-season workout sites, and you watch these pickup games where guys are playing 5-on-5 and they get pretty intense during the off-season. Guys are very competitive. I feel like that's kind of what these games will be, because you don't have fans. Obviously, you know, the difference is you have coaches at those pickup sites like at Impact. They do have refs and things like that. But the coaching staff is obviously different. But I feel like this is almost going to have a pickup type feel because there's no fans, because it's a neutral site. You know, how do you think the on-court setup, or how will the setup impact the on-court product?
This is the great unknown. We're going to ask a lot of questions like these, Alex, in the next several weeks. Questions that we have no answer to. I just don't know. I mean, they're like, I've talked recently about, I don't know if this is exactly the answer you're looking for or in this vicinity, but I mean, there's a physiological effect on your body, on your emotions, on everything when you are in a packed, loud arena, home or road, as a player and even as media. Like I've talked about this recently, where sometimes I walk into a finals game and I've got jitters and I have no stake in the outcome.
Yeah.
I don't care. But it's just, there's this certain energy that's in the arena. It's this intensity, this nervous energy. And some of it might be that, like, I know I've got to write that night and I'm on deadline, and so I've got my own nervous energy. But a lot of it is just that you can't help but be affected by the environment that you're in. And that can be energizing. It can be nerve-wracking. It can be all of the above. And so the combination of no fans, different arenas, unfamiliar arenas, just a different visuals around you, and lack of training time, the long layoff, all these things. I don't know what we're going to see. I really don't. Like I'm curious as hell what it's going to look and sound like, but I just don't think we can possibly visualize it right now or anticipate it or describe it. It's going to be something we've never seen before. And on top of that, like, even if you tried to analogize it to, like, oh, well, there's pickup games, or, you know, maybe somebody's, you know, if you got to be a fly on the wall in Chris Brickley's gym when they, during their summer runs, or at the UCLA old men's gym at UCLA where the guys, you know, play in the summers, even if you were at one of these places, I mean, there's a certain acoustics and other bodies in there, and those are familiar places to these guys. This is different. And those are pickup games. These are playoff games. This is going to be the NBA finals. And so I just don't even know what to anticipate.
Yeah, it'll be very strange. One thing you and I were talking about, you know, before we started recording here, it's not really being talked about much, but we may not have a vaccine by the time the 2020-21 NBA season starts, even if they push it back to December. You know, finishing this season is obviously the top priority, but things may not be back to normal by the time next season starts. There may still be that need for a bubble, a single site so there's no travel, games without fans, mass testing, and so on. If things go well at Disney and they're able to finish this season, do you think we could see the same setup for 2020-21, or at least a portion of it? Obviously, that's not ideal, and hopefully it doesn't have to happen. And I know we don't have answers here. Like you said, that's a long time from now. It's a long ways away. So it's really hard to predict what's going to happen in the future. But, you know, is there a possibility that this arrangement continues beyond the season potentially?
I think everything is possible. I, you know, look, we're seeing, you know, spikes in coronavirus cases in various places around the country, especially places that have been reopening fully, and it's just naturally spreading again. And so, you know, this is a roller coaster that we're on. I don't know how many more peaks and valleys that we're going to see between now and the start of next season, sometime potentially in December, maybe December 1st, maybe a little bit later than that. I mean, you know, even the epidemiologists can't tell you exactly where we're going to be that far down the road. And so is it possible the NBA would have to start next season in a bubble? Maybe. I mean, I think that'd be really tough. You can't do 82 games. You can't have everybody sequestered from their families and their entire lives for 6 months.
Right.
I don't think that's realistic, but you know, obviously the goal would be that when next season starts, you're back in your home arenas. But I think it's almost a certainty that it's without fans. It's been a while since I've asked this question. I did have a couple epidemiologists on my podcast a month and a half, 2 months ago. And, you know, the view then, and I think it's still the view now, is that until there's a vaccine, it's going to be really hard to pack 20,000 people in an arena for a game or a concert or anything else. And even if you say, well, we could do maybe 30% of capacity and space people out. Okay, maybe. But you're still congregating, you know, in bathrooms and concession stands and coming in, getting out. It's even 8,000 to 10,000 people is going to be would take some managing. And all the evidence points to the indoor spread being more of a concern than outdoor spread. So maybe it's more realistic to get baseball and football going again, where you could space people out and they're outdoors, where, you know, the air is going to disperse these droplets of virus, whereas indoors they just kind of float around and you're more likely to catch it that way. These are things that I'm sure the league has to worry about and wonder about, that we all have to be curious about for the next several months. I don't know what next season is going to look like, but I would strongly suspect it will not involve fans, no matter where they're playing.
If we're just looking at the scheduling, I'm curious what's going to happen this offseason too, because we've heard that, you know, mid-October is when the NBA Finals would wrap up, in Orlando. And then you have obviously the draft and free agency. And then, like you said, they want to get things started in December. You know, we're not sure if that's early December, mid, late. We're not really sure yet. But this offseason could be really condensed. And I've heard, you know, there's been some concern from the players and the Players Association that maybe that would be difficult. Again, you know, any situation where guys aren't able to go through the normal offseason, have to finish playing and then get started right away, you know, a few months later, could lead to more injuries, especially if, you know, next season there's talk that it'll be condensed. So there's more back-to-backs, 4 games in 5 nights. Hawks GM Travis Schlenk did a conference call this morning where he said they're talking about condensing next season and having some of those things so they can stick to the same timetable as usual. So, I mean, I just don't know how this is going to work even this offseason, getting all these things done like the draft and free agency, offseason workouts, and then getting guys started again for December. So even if it is no fans or they have to figure out how to play next season, when you look at this offseason from a scheduling standpoint, you know, are you concerned about how that'll work? You know, it'll be condensed, obviously, but what could that look like?
Well, listen, the NBA has done a really nice job over the last several years of, you know, creating a schedule that was presumably less onerous for players, right? They've been trying to create circumstances where you don't need as much load management, where players can play 82 games but not have to do a ton of back-to-backs, 4 games in 5 nights, all that stuff. So they eliminated 4 games in 5 nights. They, I think, eliminated 5 games in 7 nights and some of the other configurations where you had a lot of games packed in a short span. They cut the average number of back-to-backs from whatever it was, I think up in the 18 range down to like 12 or 13 per team. Now, if you're trying to get back on a normal schedule, on a normal calendar, and clearly the NBA is, when they put out that date of December 1st as a target date to start next season, as opposed to later December, to me, that was a clear, clear indication. And Travis Schlenk is now confirming what I kind of suspected. It was a clear indication of what the NBA is trying to do is get as close to the normal calendar as possible so that with some massaging of the schedule, you could get back to the old mid-October to, you know, mid-June calendar. If they wanted to make a permanent shift of December into July, August, they could do that with this as the impetus, just as people have been suspecting or speculating on the last couple of months. That's clearly not the goal. The goal is clearly get next season started as soon as possible. And of course, the Players Association will have something to say about that. But if you only have to make up 6 weeks, you know, normal mid-October, late October, whatever, October 22nd or whatever, I think might have been the start date for this past season. If you've only got to make up that amount of time, then yeah, you could put in a bunch of back-to-backs again. You could have one season where you do four games and five nights again, like they did not so long ago. I mean, it's not crazy. The NBA played that way not that long ago. So you could go back to four games and five nights, five and seven, a bunch of back-to-backs, or more back-to-backs than more recent seasons. And you could condense, and you could speed it up, and you could try to get back on track. The other thing you could do, that, you know, All-Star break up until a few years ago was a couple days, and then they decided to make it a week. Well, maybe All-Star break becomes just a couple days again instead of a week. And there's, you know, you buy back a few days there. So a little bit nipping and tucking here and there. And, you know, I don't know if in 1 year you get back to your old schedule, but you could get pretty close. And then by the next year you could get there. And actually, even if you spill more into summer, even if the season starts December 1st and ends like July 15th, you know, maybe you could condense the offseason a little bit, or maybe you steal a little bit from the preseason of the following year, or maybe it's just simply that you need two seasons of massaging the schedule to get back on your old calendars, setup.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see. I'm also curious with, you know, free agency and the draft. I talked to some executives and agents about, you know, how this could impact the draft. You know, will teams struggling financially be looking to trade picks for cash considerations? You know, will teams be able to work out prospects, or will they be relying on Zoom interviews and virtual workouts, kind of like we saw with the NFL? You know, there's going to be a lot of things that are kind of interesting to see with this offseason. You know, will free agency meetings be virtual, and how will that go? Will that be like the NFL's free agency process? You know, how do you think the draft and free agency will be impacted? Again, long time from now. I hate to keep just throwing these questions at you because we obviously don't have these answers, but are there any specific ways that you think we could see the draft and free agency be altered?
We know some of this already with regard to the draft, and you've ticked off some of those details. You know, I think probably the vast majority of what teams do in draft preparation is based on what they've already seen. College games or games abroad, the tape that they have available to them. And it's not to say that individual workouts aren't informative or potentially illuminating, but, you know, you could make the argument that they've got enough to go on, and then you can do all the interviews over Zoom and whatever. Free agency, I know we always think of it as this whining and dining scenario, but that hasn't happened that often. And even with the bigger stars these days, like the stars are picking where they're going without even meeting with the teams. I mean, Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant picked the Nets without even like having a meeting with the Nets or a conversation with the Nets.
Yeah.
I mean, free agency is that part's easy. You know, if you're whether you're a superstar, whether you're a mid-tier player and you've got multiple options, if you want to hear from the coach and the GM about how are you going to use me, or what's your plan for rebuilding over the next couple of years or whatever, you can do that without being there in person. I mean, they're doing most of that without being there in person anyway. So I could be wrong. I could be missing something, but I don't think free agency is going to be affected really at all.
Yeah, the NFL kind of showed that too. You saw a ton of big moves, Tom Brady going to the Bucks and all these different transactions, and no one ever met. The getting the physicals done, I think, was the hardest part. There are some players in the NFL that still haven't gotten a physical, so everything's kind of pending based on that. But some players were able to go get, you know, see their own doctor, get it done, even if the team's doctor wasn't able to see them. So yeah, it'll be interesting. Like you said with the draft, you know, teams do rely so much on scouting and game film. I'm wondering if game film, if guys, you know, guys that have great film are going to have an advantage here. You know, usually It's what guys do in workouts. If there's a guy with a ton of upside, ton of potential, a team may like that guy if he shines in a workout. And yeah, I'm wondering if maybe the older players, the guys that have more game film, and it's easier to scout that way, if those guys have an advantage. So we'll see. It'll be very interesting. You know, who knows what things will look like by then. Maybe there will be some scenario or, you know, way to work guys out at your facility. I don't know. We shall see. But let's switch gears and talk basketball a bit. If you had to predict, which teams do you have advancing to the NBA Finals, and who do you have winning it all as of right now?
It's like the ultimate trap question at this point.
I'm sorry.
In October, I think I had Clippers Bucks, and I've stuck by the Clippers as my champion for most of the year. When the season shut down, I think the Lakers were clearly the stronger team at that moment. But, you know, that moment was March 11th.
Yeah.
even at that moment, I would have said, yeah, maybe the Lakers right now. But I still, you know, my rationale for the Clippers still holds overall, which is I think they have a stronger overall supporting cast. I think that they have an element in Lou Williams that the Lakers just don't have. And even the Lou Williams, Montrezl Harrell 1-2 punch coming off the bench is just something that the Lakers don't have. Now, when you have LeBron, a lot of things that you otherwise don't have don't matter because you have LeBron. But I just my leaning toward the Clippers, and it wasn't by a lot, was always about the overall top to bottom strength of their roster and the fact that, yeah, Lou Williams can come off the bench and score 20, 25, 30 on a given night. And the Lakers just didn't have that guy. As of March 11th, the loss to the Nets notwithstanding, the Lakers were looking pretty strong, and they just had that, you know, obviously that weekend where they beat the Bucks and Clippers in the course of 3 days, for whatever that's worth. It was a strong showing. It seemed like a real statement about, you know, who they were, what they were capable of. And the Clippers have had kind of a bumpy season. So, you know, look, right now it feels like maybe Lakers over Bucks, but even then, well, a couple things. One, I've never been one who was certain about the Bucks coming out of the East. Like, Giannis is amazing. Chris Middleton's very, very good. They've got some guys, you know, a well-calibrated roster around Giannis. But I think Toronto is really good. And I think Boston has a lot of talent. And who knows what the Sixers may look like, having Embiid and Simmons finally healthy together. Like, I was never certain that the Bucks' record and their distance in the standings from their rivals necessarily meant they were automatic, and there are plenty of people around the league who agree with that feel like, yes, they've got the overall makings of a championship team, but they don't have overwhelming talent top to bottom. So I think it's wide open in a lot of ways, especially I think in the East there's like at least four teams you could make a case for. In the West it's really two teams, but then all of that goes out the window when you consider that everyone's been off for all this time. And now we get to one of the other unanswerable questions about, well, does it benefit younger teams, older teams, more experience, less experience? Is LeBron going to look creaky coming back because he's been off too long? Or will the fact that he has all this postseason experience and has seen every situation possible mean that he's going to be able to get back into it more easily than a younger team that doesn't know how to recalibrate for circumstances? I don't know. Nobody knows. We're going to make it up as we go along, and we'll see.
Yeah, I've talked to strength and conditioning coaches about that. And, you know, there is the argument, oh, young guys will stay healthy, they'll be ready to go. But then I've also heard from some that say young guys are the ones that rely on their trainers more. You know, older guys, the veterans, they have a routine. They know all the workouts. They're able to kind of go on their own and still stay in shape and do the right things. You know, and the young guys, they're not really sure what to do. And, you know, they're more reliant on the trainers and people around them that are helping them. So, yeah, I mean, you can make the argument that it helps veterans. You can make the argument that it helps young people. Who knows? We will definitely see. Is there a certain sleeper team that you're excited to watch and that could make things interesting and maybe go deep in the playoffs?
You know, everything still falls in the category, of course, of who knows, because I until we see these teams back on the court again, like, chemistry could be out the window, right? Like, all the timing, all of the rhythm, all of the everything that you build over the course of months that are part of priming for the, we always talk about, is a team peaking at the right time? You know, well, they look pretty good in January, but let's see where they are in April, or they're struggling now, but hell, they'll get it together by April or May. Like, that's all about time that you're spending together and playing together and working on this stuff. And it's all just gotten frayed over all this time that they've been apart. So the answer is who the heck knows. But I mean, if we're just going to go back to March and who I thought had a chance to emerge and be kind of a surprise, I like the Heat. I don't know if a fourth seed can be considered a surprise, but like I love what the Heat were doing, and I thought that the Heat had a chance to really make a run potentially to the conference finals, or even if things broke right, maybe even the finals. I don't think it's that big of a stretch, or at least I didn't think it was that big of a stretch in March. The West, I really don't think it's going to be anybody other than the LA teams. I was never that high on the Rockets tandem with Westbrook and Harden. I'm still unconvinced, but with unusual circumstances, presenting themselves, and can a team just get hot and a team's going to falter because they're not in rhythm or because they have an early injury? Like this is the thing. Like I think this postseason is going to turn on a lot of these unknowns and the consequences of coming back after a long layoff, and we can't anticipate what those consequences are. But that's about all I've got until we see these teams again.
No, that makes sense. One or two more things. What is your current? Who is your current most valuable player selection? Remember back a few months ago when the biggest debate and biggest concern and unanswered question among NBA fans was who the MVP was, when that was the big debate and we were all talking about that on Twitter every day? Simpler times. Who is your current MVP pick? Obviously, we'll see what happens in Orlando and how that will kind of impact things, but based on kind of the bulk of the regular season being done, who would be your pick?
At the time that the season was suspended, I absolutely believed it was Giannis, and there's no reason to change that. Now, we don't actually know if the NBA is going to hold the ballots back until they've played these 8 seeding games, because that could have an impact. Maybe not on MVP, maybe not the top 2 slots, which are, I think, very clearly Giannis and LeBron, but maybe on the other slots. If somebody makes a big push to get into the playoffs seedings, or team goes 8-0 and improves their spot in the standings, I mean, we have to at least consider that in the balloting, don't we? But I don't know. The NBA has not indicated when those ballots are going to be distributed and whether those seeding games are going to count and be considered or not. But when the season stopped, I thought it was pretty clear that Giannis as MVP with LeBron second. I can give you my rationale for that if you want it, but I there's nothing that will have changed that, obviously, in all this time that's been off.
Yeah, what's your rationale for Giannis over LeBron? I'm just curious.
So it's a couple different things. I always say that MVP is about two factors, and I'll consider these kind of indisputable: individual excellence and team success, and you have to have both. And so if if your team has a great record, but your stats aren't all that great, then that kind of, drags you down a little bit. If your stats are spectacular, like, say, James Harden's, but your team is in the bottom half of the bracket, it's hard to be MVP. The history of this league, with the Russell Westbrook year notwithstanding, the history of this league for 35 years plus is that you're on a true contender, an identifiable contender, top 2, top 3 in your conference. So Giannis and LeBron both fit all of that. And so then it comes down more to, whose stats are even gaudier than the others. And, you can parse that a number of different ways, but the Bucks also have been start to finish the best team by record. That matters to me. Giannis is at a different level defensively at this stage of his career than LeBron is, even though LeBron was much more attentive this season than prior. It's not a massive gap. And I also thought at the time that the season shut down, with a month plus to play, I thought it was possible LeBron could have caught him. But once those games were wiped off, I think that made it really tough. And one of the things that was in play there, of course, too, was the Bucks had started to tail off a little bit record-wise, performance-wise. What if the Lakers had come up with the best record in the league? To me, that would have strengthened LeBron's case over Giannis, because, again, I think the record and your team's success matters. And you know, that would have been among the factors I would have considered. But as of things were when the season stopped, it was Giannis over LeBron.
Yeah, that's how I have it too. I have Giannis over LeBron. You know, like you said though, the Bucks lost 3 straight games right before the season was postponed, and they only have 4 more wins right now than the Lakers. So it was going to be interesting to see how things played out. Obviously, I think the 8 games, the remainder of the regular season, that probably benefits Giannis because, as you were saying, you know, how things were headed, the Lakers seemed to have some momentum. The Bucks were kind of tailing off, and there was enough time for LeBron to make that gap up. Now I'm not sure that's possible with 8 games, but you know, we shall see. One more thing here. I want to talk about your article that looks back on Kobe Bryant's lob to Shaquille O'Neal, which launched their dynasty. You know, you had great quotes in there from Shaq, Rick Fox, Derek Fisher, a bunch of others. It was fantastic. What were some of your favorite memories from covering those Shaq Kobe teams?
Yeah, thanks. It was a really fun project to do. I'd been wanting to do that one for a long time. Favorite moments from covering those teams. I mean, that was one of them. It's one of the reasons I always wanted to revisit that moment, the lob and game 7 against the Blazers in 2000, was because that was where it all began. And also because that series was so intense, so taut, and because everything tipped in that moment. You know, the dynasty was born then, but the dynasty could have easily been derailed then. Being down 15 points in game 7 at home, and in a time when 15 points was more significant than 15 points is right now in today's NBA. It was a thrilling series and a thrilling moment, and seeing Shaq and Kobe collaborate at that level. And then a couple weeks later, when they win the championship, Kobe jumping into Shaq's arms, I can still see that image in my head, and knowing everything that they would go through after that, and some of what they'd already been through to that point. It was just so poignant and so moving. And you know, obviously it's hard to look at anything now through the same lens after, you know, Kobe's passing in January. You know, everything feels like it takes on a little bit more significance and weight. So I covered the team for 7 years, from 97 to 04, so a couple of early flameouts, the three-peat, stumbling in 2003, and then just disintegrating in 2004 when Shaq and Kobe just didn't even want anything to do with each other by the time they were losing to the Pistons in the finals. And just a lot along the way, in going back and talking to you know, Shaq and Fox and Shaw, Ori, for this story, it was just a nice reminder of something that, you know, I kind of have known all along and never really forgotten anyway. But like, these guys were all just really good guys and really smart and thoughtful people. And where Shaq and Kobe could run hot and cold at times, because that's what happens when you're the stars of a team, and especially if you're stars who are fighting with each other. And so when it comes to the media, there are days that you're not, you know, in the mood, or you're not that forthcoming. And you know, guys like Rick Fox and Robert Horry, Derek Fisher, Brian Shaw, Ron Harper, Horace Grant, we're always so giving of their time and their insights to put everything in perspective. And as a reporter, as a writer covering a team day in, day out, where, you know, it's challenging at times to contextualize the story correctly, and and also just to keep it fresh. And these guys were so great, and it was just so much fun talking to them all again for this, because we share a lot of the same memories and impressions of what that time was like, but theirs are obviously much more informed than mine because they were in it. And I was just, you know, the, you know, observer from a few feet away. So, much appreciation to all those guys for all that they, shared back then. And again, now, and I should, you know, shout out the Blazers too. Bonzi Wells, Damon Stoudemire, Scottie Pippen and Greg Anthony, Steve Smith and Mike Dunleavy were all phenomenal for that story that I just did. Had a blast talking to all of them too. You know, it's always fun when you get to talk to people about something from years before, because everybody's always a little bit more honest about it, you know, 20 years later than they were at the time. And their memories are still sharp, but the way that they frame it might be a little bit different because they've got the benefit of years of perspective.
Yeah, it was a fantastic piece. We'll link to it in the post on Hoopsite. For anyone that missed it or wants to check it out, be sure to check out the post, and we'll have the link in there. Last question for you, Howard. when you're covering a game or you're, you know, out walking your dog or whatever, how often do people come up to you and say, "What up, Beck?"
I have a cat, not a dog, so I'm not out not walking the dog. I get it in Brooklyn here at home. I've gotten it on the subway. I've gotten it on the street. And those are the ones that surprise me, because I don't ever expect anybody to actually just recognize me out every day. And these are people who are complete strangers usually. And so it startles me every time. And I kind of chuckle and just say, "Hi, thanks." when it happens in NBA arenas, I'm like at Summer League, those are hardcore NBA fans who, of course, they're all going to be hardcore Zach Lowe fans and you know, avid listeners of his podcast. If it's in an NBA arena during the season, again, like, these are people who, like, I would expect that they are, one, big Zach Lowe fans, and two, might actually recognize me. But since I'm not a TV person and I don't do a lot of stuff on camera, I'm always startled by it, because I just don't expect anybody to recognize me, frankly. But I love it. I appreciate it. It's flattering. And so, you know, I never would discourage anybody from hitting me with the "What up, Beck?" It's fun.
I love it. I love that Steve Kerr and others have, you know, even joined in and referenced it. It's so cool. It's
Steve,
fun to see.
Steve loves doing it. Steve thinks it's hilarious. So.
Well, Howard, this has been so much fun. I know things are crazy right now, so thank you so much for making time to do this. I really appreciate it, man.
No, thanks for having me, Alex. My pleasure. Appreciate it.
Make sure you guys all check out Howard's podcast, The Full 48. Make sure you follow Howard on Twitter at Howard Beck. Also, check out the Bleacher Report app and follow their social media accounts. If you guys want to hear more episodes of the Hoopsite podcast, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere podcasts are found. And until next time, thanks for listening.